Welcome to the 1977 SmackDown. I'm really excited to welcome our panel. We have first-timer Sarah Black McCullough. Hello, Sarah.
Oh, hey, hi, sir.
Am I pronouncing your last name correct?
Yeah, that was perfect.
Okay. And Mark Harris.
Hey, everyone.
Nick Davis.
Don't mind my giant hat.
Hey, you got to have somewhere to smuggle that $50,000.
That's right.
And Guy Lodge.
Hello.
So, thanks for everybody for watching these movies, which weren't necessarily... I'm not sure I'm necessarily all that fond of 1977 after a big viewing spree. Quick start off, do any of you have strong memories of 1977 from before? I know not all of you were alive, but... Like for me, I was alive, but the only thing I remember actually seeing in the theater was The Rescuers.
Oh yeah.
And For the Love of Benji. Those are my two actual memories from movie theaters in 1977.
To bait me into admitting that I was the only sentient adult or you know, conscious person in 1977. I was not an adult, but I do have memories of it. What I really remember is long lines and things played in movie theaters forever. Like, I grew up in New York City, and Julia opened this one-screen theater called the Cinema One, which was, like, back then the most prestigious single theater in New York. And it played for so long that eventually it gave way to Fonda's next movie, Coming Home. Like... She had seamless Oscar-nominated performances, and she kind of owned that theater for something like 8 months.
How long did For the Love of Benji play?
I'm sure I was online for it, but I don't remember.
I have one more. I just remembered. Herbie Goes to Monte Carlo. I also saw that at the drive-in theater with my family. So, yes, I am old enough to remember drive-in theaters.
Yeah. I was not alive during 1977, but I do, sort of looking back when people have always talked about it, definitely Saturday Night Fever is what everyone seems to talk about. Mm-hmm. And then Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So, I to me, it's always been... at least from those two movies, just a lot of fantasy and a lot of visuals and aesthetics. Like, it just, a lot of the films that were very big then seem to be driven by aesthetics, and that's how people remember them. Mm-hmm. And then I also, yeah, I, as a child too, I've seen The Rescuers, so I just didn't know that that was in 1977, but that's a big one. That and, sorry, movie soundtracks were very... That's how I sort of remember the soundtracks, choreography, and aesthetics.
Mm-hmm. And how about you, Guy?
Well, I also wasn't alive in 1977. as I said, I mean, I remember seeing The Rescuers down under in theaters, so that's the sort of generational divide.
Okay.
but, I mean, actually, the first film I always think of with 1977 is Annie Hall, because I actually think I saw that before I saw Star Wars. Yeah, 1977 was very much discovered on VHS for me.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I kind of think of that as, because Woody Allen, you know, even despite latter-day sins, one of my favorite filmmakers, mm-hmm. I kind of think of that as where, you know, the kind of turning point, so to speak, of his own career. So,
mm-hmm. No segue intended. The turning point. Actually, my only... I didn't really know what the Oscars were in 77 because my family was not very, they weren't really into showbiz, you know. But I do remember my first Oscar memory is actually from 1977, but I didn't really have context for it. I guess it would be 1978, but the first time I remember anybody talking about the Oscars was my family complaining that Annie Hall beat Star Wars. That was literally the first time I remember anybody talking about the Oscars, but I didn't really get it until the 80s, you know. But
we're, so checked we're out Inside Oscar for a year at the Army Base Library in Germany. I had to renew it 26 times every 2 weeks, and I thought they would eventually just give it to me, but they were jerks. Because I read it so obsessively, one day my brother just picked it up and flipped to the 1977 page in the back and was like, Star Wars Lost? And then he just threw it down and never looked at it again.
That's funny. So we've all been avoiding Star Wars, I think the world, that's the only... Well, maybe Saturday Night Fever, those two movies that people constantly think of from 1977.
Yeah.
I just want to say that I avoided Star Wars the first time. I have very vivid 1977 memories of my father and my brother being incredibly excited to see it and me looking at the print ad and thinking, eh, not for me. I think I was much more excited about Smokey and the Bandit.
Yeah. Yeah, Mark, I loved your note about seeing Annie Hall then and not getting it, and then getting it suddenly, not too long after that.
Oh, yeah, but I loved that feeling, and I'm sure you all had this when you're like 13 or 14 or 15, stuff you don't get in movies is kind of exciting, like references and jokes that sort of point you toward the existence of a larger world that you don't know about. Like, everything in movies at that age feels like vital information.
I wonder if people still have that curiosity, though. It seems like people are very upset on the internet when you point out something that they don't know.
True, yeah.
I wonder if there's anything in a mainstream movie that a 13-year-old wouldn't know. I mean, they all seem pretty tailored to make sure that, you know, nothing will fly over anybody's head.
Yeah, that's true.
And I wonder, too, I think, like, as kids, all of us can say, like, I never had Google as a child to sort of look things up, so it felt like something I would learn later on, and that kind of added to the excitement of it. But I wonder if kids sort of lose that aspect now where they don't have time to wait. They can just Google it without, you know, understanding it. I don't know, or, like, you know, with wisdom and age and understanding something a little later than just, like, immediately Googling it and then, you know.
Well, yeah, no, I actually thought of that specifically with Close Encounters. When I watched it again a few years ago when I first got the collector's edition, my favorite scene in the picture is when Richard Dreyfuss doesn't notice the Devil's Tower on the TV.
Yeah.
And he's building that big sculpture. And that was, it was so, like, not nostalgia, but it was, like, a mnemonic device suddenly for how I remember feeling as a kid when you didn't, it could take a really long time to learn about things and you didn't know where the information was going to come from.
Yeah.
Like, you could go to the library, that was like a standby if you really wanted to look something up, but otherwise it was kind of like, you know, you would look through books or you would chance upon information, but there wasn't, you know, it felt very more happenstance and lively about learning about things.
That went for the Oscars, too. Like, I think one reason Nick and I were both obsessed with Inside Oscar was you really couldn't get full lists of historical nominees anywhere else. I mean, they're you know, before the internet, it's not like that information was widely available in books or magazines.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you could follow, you know, monthly with magazines sometimes, what was happening in terms of like people talking about what might be nominated, but even that was like very, very spotty.
Right.
And because of that, misinformation could actually stick for much longer. I think there was a case when I'd heard someone was nominated for an Oscar for, I can't remember, it was something quite obscure, and I just assumed it was true for ages, and so I kind of, you know, finally got like a copy of Inside Oscar and was like, that never happened.
Let's start with Julia, because I think it's the most curious of the five movies for a number of reasons.
Well, that's saying something.
I'm never quite sure. I've seen it a few times now, and like, I never dislike it, and I never like it, but I find it, I don't know if it's the feeling of it's like several movies in one.
Yes.
Or if Vanessa Redgrave just has very different ideas about the movie than other people. But I find it fascinating, even though I don't think it's very good.
You know, for me, like, watching it this time, I was struck by the fact that it still has one foot very firmly in a much earlier mode of prestige filmmaking. Like, it's a 1977 movie, but but it's directed by Fred Zinnemann very near the end of his career. So in some ways, it's really like a 60s or a 50s movie even. But it is weird because it's kind of a movie about whose story really is this. You know, Lillian Hellman is nominally at the center, and she was, of course, this very self-venerating writer who you know, famously was accused of embroidering things to sort of aggrandize herself. Mm-hmm. And yet, the movie is about a main character, Lillian Hellman, who acts as a supporting character to the person who is, in the movie, a supporting character, but in the story the movie is telling, the main character. Mm-hmm. So it's like who it belongs to is... I found that kind of interesting, revisiting it again after all these years. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I like what you had said, Mark, too. I think it was your piece about how you remember it as being like this huge Vanessa Redgrave performance, but she's actually like one of the smallest screen times of any of these nominees.
Yeah, it was startling to me.
She has like a 2 or 3 big scenes, and that's about it.
The handoff in the restaurant is the really... When I watched it this time, I thought, oh, well, that's where the Oscar came from, that sequence.
Yeah. Which is basically the climax of the picture, only the movie keeps going. because of that notion of whose story is it. So suddenly it's Lillian's story again, but Lillian's story is still obsessing over Julia's story. Like refusing to let it end.
It's funny how they do structure her as kind of that supporting figure within all these different narratives, and yet the movie's quite intent on having her on the screen all the time, and that it keeps suggesting that all these people around her, to include Dash and even some of the people in the New York scene, have in this telling a little more obvious charisma or a little more sense of who they are or what they're about. But they all really have to fight to have more than one or two scenes. I mean, Robards' Oscar is even more kind of stymieing in terms of what he was rewarded for based on what's up there on the screen to judge.
Or Maximilian Schell's nomination.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Too. Yeah.
Because he's in it for like two scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Not that those scenes aren't good scenes, but it's just baffling, the nominations.
Well, one thing that struck me about it is, and maybe this connects to it, is what a generous actor Jane Fonda is. Like, not just in this movie, but in many movies, she really makes room for other performers. So when she's in that scene with Maximilian Schell, she makes sure that that scene is about Maximilian Schell's performance. The same thing even with you know, the very brief Meryl Streep appearance. You know, that's a great little showcase for someone who was then a brand new actress. You know, Fonda could have made sure that the camera was on these other people less. It could have been more keyed to her reactions to everyone, but she really kind of steps back and lets it be a story about these bigger and more intense people, you know, coming at Lillian Hellman, and Lillian Hellman sort of watching and listening.
Mm-hmm. It connects to an interesting thing about Jane Fonda. I think it was one of our readers, Cal, who mentioned this, that her power of her persona is kind of like as a witness. And because of like how many different like film periods she's endured and been important to in political events. And then also this movie is very much like that with her. It's a very strange leading role. But for that exact reason, like, it seems like it's not ever really about her.
There's also something so fundamentally tenacious and punchy about Fonda that it is, to me, interesting and sometimes productively and sometimes feels a little difficult, especially in a movie like this, to see that recurrent generosity that Mark is talking about, and to see her experiment with playing a character who's really at such a loss about where her creativity is coming from and if there's any left and where her politics are coming from and whether they're all borrowed or not, to have that played by such a steely person who it's, I think, a huge challenge for Jane Fonda to play down that inveterate steeliness that she has, mm-hmm. Which comes through vocally a lot. And so it becomes a kind of storytelling conundrum where I feel sometimes like I'm watching a really strong person act like she's weak, but I can't tell if that's two sides of Lillian or if that's, Fonda trying to play somebody possibly less resolute than she is, which is also strange because of how resolute, as Mark was saying, Hellman herself is usually thought to be. So to see both of them in this mode of, mm-hmm. of being so watery is surprising.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first time you see her, she's blocked. She's typing and she's not, it's not working. And it's also not working because she's smoking while she's typing, and she looks like someone who's never smoked while she's typing before. Like it just drives me crazy. Like the no hands cigarette, like bobbing up and down in her mouth, which, you know, it's like, I guarantee you Lillian Hellman smoked like 12 trillion cigarettes while she wrote and knew how to deal with a cigarette in her mouth while her fingers were, you know, on the keyboard. And I guarantee you Fonda would have figured that out too, but the movie seems to want to make her look like she's not sort of fully competent, and that's frustrating.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I also wanted to discuss too, I think Nathaniel, you had brought it up in your email as well, but just I found that the way female friendship was sort of depicted was a little more interesting. I know it was very confusing at the time because a lot of people alluded to like a possible relationship. And I think even Hellman's original memoir on this was very vague as to who it was and what the nature of the relationship was. But I found that Fonda was very watery, but I also found that was very indicative of what it meant to be a woman then who was trying to make a voice for herself. And yet, you know, Dash was always telling her, as much as he's a very supportive mentor figure, has to sort of see her break down, but then also succeed. And I found that kind of interesting. It made me feel a little ambivalent about Fonda's representation of Hellman, but then I also found it was very true, you know, to how a woman can be in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. that she has to be strong, but she's also equally weak, and that there is a supporting figure there, but even he sort of challenges her on, you know, being a human being in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a distinct, like, whiff of the sort of, not Pygmalion exactly, but, like, mm-hmm. that idea that he created her.
Yeah, and that he or discovered her or shaping yeah. her, I think, is a narrative. It's something so prevalent in a lot of narratives, at least for female artists, that you've been discovered, and then once you have, you know, you have no agency, and you've been shaped and molded into the public figure that you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which makes an actually interesting contrast with Vanessa Redgrave and the title character.
Yes.
Because it's all self, not even really self-invention, but self-driven. Like, everything feels like it's coming internally from her, like the entire plot yes. and, like, everything.
But then at the same time, too, Julia is sort of writing a role for her as well. Like, she is telling her to act a certain way and is sort of giving her direction as well.
Oh,
and I wonder
true.
How much of that, like, I wonder, because Julia is we don't get to see a lot of Julia, but I think that in a lot of ways, Julia seems to understand that Lillian is sort of putting a lot on this relationship or really cares about it a lot. And I wonder how much of that factors into getting her to come and, you know, do all these things for her.
Yeah, one of the most fascinating parts of Vanessa's performance for me is how much she tempers, like, Julia's actual affection for Lillian mm-hmm. with sort of condescension and maybe manipulation.
Absolutely. I mean, telling her what hat to wear, and even the women on the train with her are telling her what to do and sort of act on her mm-hmm. to protect her, but also, you know, she's so impressionable, it seems.
Mm-hmm. And yet, Julia, I mean, Hellman is the one who's in charge of telling the entire story,
exactly.
So it's only her version of it you're getting. I mean, I think one yeah. reason that Redgrave's performance is so resonant sort of in the Oscar race is it's so much a movie about acting. not only like acting in the sense of will you have the courage of your political convictions and actually risk yourself to act on them, but it's a movie about performance. I mean, the whole climax of the movie is built on various people giving Fonda direction, you know, as if when she's on the train, it's almost as if like she's the actor in an improv sketch who doesn't know that it's improv, and everyone is saying like, no, I'm going to take candy now and you're going to act like it's okay. And then when they get to the restaurant, I think that's a really fascinating scene. I was trying to think of another movie from that time where it's all about two women and one of them is basically directing the other. Like, what, you know, that scene is in so many ways about Redgrave giving a performance while very calmly extracting a performance from Fonda. Mm-hmm. So it's, I mean, the layers and what Redgrave does there and the risk of it, because it, there's also this kind of undertone that, like, what you're getting out of that scene is Redgrave knows how to do this better than Fonda. I found it the most interesting part of the movie and still something that you don't see, I haven't seen in a lot of movies since then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jumping back a second, because Sarah, you brought this up, but we didn't really explore it. Like the idea of their female friendship, which I think is actually, female relationships are actually really important to all but one of these nominees this time. I was wondering what everybody makes of that very, very odd scene late in the picture that's actually about Meryl Streep's character, Anne Marie.
Yeah.
And there's all these implications there. It's like the only time that the potential lesbianism of Lillian and Julia's relationship is brought up. It's a very strange scene because I can never read, like, what are we supposed to be offended for, Lillian? Is this because the way Jane and Vanessa play it, I feel that sort of that their relationship is partly not just homosocial, but maybe sexual also. So it's very strange. Like all of the mixed messages about gayness in this movie and, well, it's not mixed messages in Looking for Mr. Goodbar, but there's a lot of strange gay things happening in these five movies, like the sort of outre flamboyant gay performance that's a story point in Goodbye Girl. Mm-hmm. So for those who haven't seen The Goodbye Girl, because I know it's a little harder to see for some reason now than it was just very recently, Richard Dreyfuss's character gets a job playing Richard III, and the director expects him to play it as, like, a gay man.
And not just a gay man.
Right.
Yeah.
And the very strange thing about that story point in that movie is that they come to an agreement halfway through the movie, okay, well, let's use it as subtext, and then you see the actual performance. And I'm like, I don't know if any of these people understand what the word subtext means.
I think that was actually based in part on a sort of controversial public theater production in New York from a few years earlier where Michael Moriarty, I may be misremembering this, but I think Michael Moriarty played an unusually feminized or effeminate Richard III, and there was a lot of sneering at the time. I mean, I don't think you can underestimate either in Julia or The Goodbye Girl the degree to which this is just kind of old guard period homophobia. I mean, in The Goodbye Girl, it's really like, oh, look at this poofy English director trying to make everyone gay. And in Julia, I mean, you know, it's Lillian Hellman. She wrote The Children's Hour, the point of which was that, like, you know, there is absolutely nothing worse than a vicious rumor, and the most vicious rumor you could possibly come up with is that, you know, two perfectly clean, ordinary women were actually dirty lesbians. So it's hard to read it as, for me, as anything other than that, which was really common, you know, 40 years ago.
So, yeah, I'm wondering, Guy, we haven't heard from you a lot, but what do you think of this sort of, like, unexpected gay thread through three of the five movies?
Well, in Julia in particular, I keep wondering how unexpected or planned it is. Watching it again, we were talking about it being a story of female friendship, but I'm kind of wondering if it's a story about one-way female friendship in a way, because as you say, it's Julia directing Lillian,
mm-hmm.
and yet it seems to be taking place so much in Lillian's kind of headspace, right down to the, I don't know whether it's coincidental or not, but the kind of gauzy, dusty visual style of the movie. There's something almost dreamlike about it.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of, so I wonder, even in the scenes where it's just Julia, there's part of me that wants to sort of interpret them as kind of Lillian's fantasy of her, or her sort of idealized, you know, vision of this woman that she sort of admires intensely, but doesn't seem to know very well at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder how much one might read that as a kind of romantic or sexual fixation to some extent. But
I mean, I read it mostly because of Fonda's performance as partly a sexual fixation. I'm not saying it's in the text, but I just think the actors at least are aware of it in a less judgmental way than maybe the material is.
And I wonder if that's coming from the actors as well, because I wonder if, you know, Fonda maybe regarded Vanessa Redgrave in a similar way. I mean, they're both such kind of politically, you know, woke actresses, to use the current term.
Well, and in Fonda's memoir, she talks about having not felt particularly politically inclined until seeing Vanessa Redgrave speak at a, it wasn't a rally exactly, but sort of an activist meeting in Hollywood, which was several years before this. And totally fixating on the impression it made on her that somebody whose artistry she already admired felt totally syncopated with this really trenchant political intelligence. And they didn't know each other very well, but that she really was the figure who had inspired a different turn and kind of a more ferocious one in Fonda's own politics. So this is them being reunited several mm-hmm. years after that. And so it really does kind of parallel the character narratives in lots of interesting ways.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like I'm not alone in maybe not loving the movie, but finding it a completely fascinating movie that I will probably watch again, and I've already seen it like 3 times.
I also find it a very useful movie because it's the one I always bring up when the kind of category fraud conversation comes up in the Oscar season every year,
mm-hmm.
when there's always some kind of very literal minded dunce who, like in the case of this year with Carol, we're like, well, it's not called Therese, it's called Carol. So obviously, Carol is important. So, you know, you can always throw Julia back at them, and it's. I'm grateful for that, if nothing else.
I know, Sarah, you did not love the performance as much as the rest of us.
I think because I just wanted more, and I think for a lot of it too, and maybe this is just a bias that I have that I. Especially within a supporting role, I think I just yearned to see what the relationship was exactly, and it was my first time watching the film, and there was just a lot missing for me because I've seen other Vanessa Redgrave performances, and maybe I was comparing them to that as well, but I just wasn't particularly fond of it. I will say that end scene is probably one of the best ones, but I was just so frustrated because most of it was flashback, and you know, it was them kind of frolicking in, you know, the countryside, and it was a little frustrating for me at times to watch because I know Vanessa Redgrave is, you know, like a phenomenal actress. So it was really frustrating for me to see so little of her. And I just found that the relationship was just very cold, and it just felt really out of place. And even that last scene felt in some ways very out of place for me.
Well, yeah, I'm wondering, like, with the frustration there, because that is a typical thing that comes up with supporting performances, is how much they're giving versus how much you want from them.
And I think, I can't remember who just brought this up too, but it did feel that last scene felt like the end of the film or close to it, and it was just so frustrating to see keep going, and Julia brings up another child, and it was just a lot going on, and it just felt like nothing was really anchored anywhere, and that's what was a little more frustrating for me.
Mm-hmm.
just in terms of being Oscar nominated as well. Like it was a very frustrating year, clearly. So.
Well, I mean, I think that's a good way to move into, because I think your favorite performance was Quinn Cummings, and I know that that's Nick's second favorite. So let's move to her.
Yeah.
Because child actor is Mark's favorite subject as well.
Yeah.
I personally am often allergic to child actors, and I didn't.
Absolutely.
I didn't have an issue with Quinn Cummings. I thought she was completely good the whole movie. I just don't really understand. I understand that the movie was a huge hit and everything in the year, but I just didn't really feel like any of them were Oscar worthy, so to speak. It was just sort of enjoyable, a little grating, you know, romantic comedy. But I'm wondering, Nick, you had said you had watched a bunch of Neil Simon recently, so I'd love to hear from you about this.
Well, just because going back through the supporting nominees of all these recent years that I've been doing means having to watch a bunch of Neil Simon. And and there are some performances that just feel, you know, variety is the spice of life, etc. So it's great that there are so many performers who seem convinced that they are speaking great language. And then there are people like Jane Fonda, actually, in California Suite, who seem to really be trying to be in a milieu with Neil Simon that is not coming to them at all naturally, but they're really trying. And so it doesn't work when you look like you're really trying. And Quinn Cummings, I think Mark made the same point, or maybe Sarah did too, that it's just remarkable how she seems to be in a completely plausible reality and is just speaking her mind.
Okay.
I mean, it's not a performance that I have a lot of thoughts about. I just really enjoy it, and I'm impressed at how easy she makes it look to just enjoy that character and that whole verbal idiom.
Mm-hmm. Especially in the 70s when the sort of profusion of TV sitcoms was really encouraging a kind of quippy, robotic, utterly inhuman performance style in children. I mean, you can see just awful, awful, awful work from children in a lot of shows from the mid-70s. And so in that context, her kind of ease with language and sort of inhabiting that little kid is really sort of disarmed me. I was prepared not to think very much of the performance, and I really kind of liked it, especially in her last big scene, which is the carriage ride scene with Richard Dreyfuss. And she actually seems to be playing a genuine little kid who is wrestling with a complicated set of feelings. And for me, it's one of the most, like, that and the utterly shattered expression on Richard Dreyfuss's face after he knows he's given a terrible, terrible performance in the play and he can't even take in compliments from Marsha Mason and Quinn Cummings. Those are, like, to me, the two really human moments in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree that scene with Dreyfuss in the theater is a really strong moment that feels like it's cutting through all the false... all the false haha.
But Guy, Quinn Cummings kind of played to you like one of those sitcom performances, right?
Very much so. I feel like a real kind of Scrooge now, because I think I'm the only one star.
That was the subtext of my question.
I don't blame her so much. As I wrote in my thing, I think she is actually, you know, quite a natural, charming presence. But to me, she's not quite selling that language, or not quite selling me on who that person even is, because I think she's such a confusingly written character, because she seems so precocious in some ways that, you know, Neil Simon has kind of clearly imagined for her, and so kind of improbably clueless in others, that she just never quite manages to knit those two sort of states of childhood together for me. And so, yeah, I didn't find her, you know, especially unpleasant to watch. I just didn't really know who she was playing. And so for that reason, I couldn't really rank her much higher than that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, these are very That's an interesting reaction, and I totally see where you're coming from because I'm almost there. But Neil Simon's writing in this is so overworked that it's almost like having a character be underdeveloped is kind of a surprise.
Yeah.
Because of how overworked.
But I found that in a lot, I saw that too, but I found in a lot of ways it was because she has to play sort of a support system for her own mother and then also has to be a child because the male figures, you know, sort of come in and out of their lives that they're, you know, whenever her mother is dealing with a breakup, she's there to sort of throw in a punch line or, you know, just something to kind of ease the pain of her own mother and also her own disappointment. Mm-hmm. So I definitely felt that way too, but I find that children in those roles either, you know, I think like Guy had said, they're very, not, they're just like extremely robotic or they just feel like characters, but I felt like she was a little more confused because that's just what a child in that kind of situation would sort of be like, and that's, and she played it with such a confidence that I don't think I've ever, like, there's like a self-assurance in the performance that I've never seen or you rarely see in a child actor, and that really threw me off because I didn't think I was going to like that at all, that performance.
Mm-hmm. One thing, this isn't a defense of the movie so much as a contextualization of it, but I think it might be useful to remember that the idea of Marsha Mason as a single mother raising her kid on her own after the husband leaves was much more in the center of public discourse 40 years ago when, I mean, people were really, really talking about how the divorce rate in America was going through the roof and were beginning to grapple in. I'm not saying that, like, The Goodbye Girl is an issue movie, but it's, like, I think the very next year or that year even, maybe we had, no, not that year, but An Unmarried Woman was right around that time. And
Kramer versus Kramer, 2 years right, later, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, so this subject was very much on the agenda, and I guess I have a personal, like, soft spot for The Goodbye Girl because it was filmed right in my neighborhood. I mean, at the very end, when she's coming through a fence in a public school and Richard Dreyfuss picks her up in a carriage, like, that's my block. literally the street that I grew up on, the school that I live next to, the public library across from the school that I went to all the time. And so as a sort of Upper West Side New York kid, I completely recognized that dynamic when I saw the movie as a kid of harried single mother who, like, was just barely keeping it together and kids who sort of know how to parent themselves a little bit and end up parenting their parents. Obviously, yeah, the Neil Simon writing gives it this very sort of snappy, overwrought, you know, style that now feels purely mechanical. But the character dynamics were, you know, fresher 40 years ago, including the idea that, like, what would be so bad if this woman, like, met this schlubby actor who was trying to make, like, you know, that it was totally okay for her to bring this guy into her daughter's life and her life, and the movie wasn't interested in punishing her for that. So I just, like, I'm not making any kind of case that, like, well, at the time, this was a masterpiece. But, you know, I'm just saying, like, at the time, it was certain things that we absolutely take for granted were slightly fresher.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, actually, in a lot of 70s movies, even particularly here in like a comedy, there is a real weird, even though the Goodbye Girl is very childish in a lot of ways, there's a real, like, adult undercurrent to movies that you don't really have anymore.
Yeah, true.
Absolutely.
I have a soft spot for it because when my dad started to clock that I was getting interested in movies, the ones he really wanted me to watch were Lawrence of Arabia and Bridge on the River Kwai and Reds and The Goodbye Girl. And I thought, oh, you know. So one of these is definitely different than the other ones. But I did kind of get raised on it in a way. And I don't think anybody in the movie is I don't want to sound like I'm alleging that anyone is performing against the grain of the script or Simon style, quite the opposite. And yet, the way in which if I just read the script on the page or think about the lines, it does get a little bit much to me how totally determined each line of dialogue is on its effect for 2 hours. But they don't play it that way. And I feel like, I know people react to this movie differently, but I do actually find it quite charming and get pretty swept up in it, even though there's often a voice in the back of my head saying, you don't like any almost any other movies based on this guy's work. There are moments in the plotting and even in the performances that sometimes seem pretty miscalculated. But I like it. I've probably seen it 8 times.
I would have been happy to follow Marsha Mason deeper into the chorus line, all that jazz ripoff portion of her.
Yes, yeah. Like,
I can't say all that jazz ripoff because all that jazz was later, but that plot line is definitely drawn from a chorus line, which is years earlier.
Yeah, totally. That's the end of part one. We'll pick it up in a moment with one more anecdote on the Goodbye Girl and then move on to Turning Point, Close Encounters, and Looking for Mr. Goodbar, so stay tuned.